Was still crying as they rode. And her son asked her why she was crying. And in a moment of honesty as they headed toward that fate, she told him that she had kept kosher all her life, but now she was on her way to die and she's crying because her children are young and will not have the chance to live, she fears. And on top of it all, she had to choose between her responsibility to put food before them versus her responsibility to keep her faith correctly. Her pain is palpable as one hears that story. And saddest in that is the compelling moment where she admits that she feels like a failure. Theologian Wendy Farley tells that story in her writing on Mark chapter 2. And explains that we should remember that Jews have always prioritized keeping Torah, but have also understood that when a life needs to be saved, all means, every means, were valid choices. Clearly, at least one of this mother's children did survive. He told the story. But from a hunger standpoint, at that point in their lives, she saved his life in some way with her provision. But in the process, you caught that she felt as though she had committed a terrible sin. Maybe that one's a little hard for us to get our minds around as we hear a story. We don't relate to keeping kosher, most of us. But I bet you've been put in other tough situations. I bet you've been put in situations that caused you to wonder how your faith related to the situation that was in front of you and the set of choices that you had to make. Life doesn't always give us ideal conditions under which to live. But I gotta ask, is there ever a bad day to heal somebody? This story that was read from Mark's gospel just a minute ago is really one of four controversy stories that we see right as Mark comes out of the gates. Alan Culpepper says that each of these controversy stories, right off the bat in Mark's gospel, give Jesus a chance to define religious priorities in light of the system that he has been raised in and that in front of which he teaches. Jesus was walking around with his disciples in chapter 2. That's what guys do sometimes. We just walk around. We don't really get a lot of context for this story. We don't know, for instance, that his trip to the synagogue on the Sabbath was actually the destination as they were walking in the end of chapter 2. We don't know that those two things are connected. They simply are told one right before the other. And the Greek literally says they were out walking around. And they went through, they cut through a neighbor's grain field. And the verbiage suggests that the disciples may have been making a way for Jesus. Again, that's a fairly literal translation. They were making a way with him following behind them. This was not illegal, by the way. Plucking from a neighbor's field without their notice, plucking from a neighbor's field without going and asking their permission or being invited, was not illegal. It might violate our modern sensibilities, our sense of space and belongings, since if you looked out your window and saw someone, a stranger or a friend, just helping themselves to the flowers in your yard or something in your garden, you might feel a little violated. They had a different set of margins between theft and sharing in their time and place than we do. What was illegal, though, about this was that picking grain was one of 39 varieties of work that were specifically forbidden in the Torah from happening on the Sabbath. You couldn't pick grain. You know, I've been by the way, I should tell you this. Moses and Aaron, if you wonder how serious that prohibition was, Moses and Aaron once allowed the congregation of Israel to stone a man to death for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. They didn't teach that one to us in vacation Bible school. I don't know why. So, was it illegal? What was it illegal about this picking of grain? Is that what mattered the most? The Pharisees were right there to begin the questioning in light of what the disciples were doing. And I'm on a personal kick, you'll hear me refer to this from time to time, about us not always immediately assuming the worst when we see a Pharisee pop up in a story around Jesus. Or when we hear a Pharisee ask Jesus a question. They had a job to do. Their job was to maintain the fidelity of the faith and see that the law was followed. So they weren't always necessarily automatically up to something bad, although often they were. So I'm just trying to not assume that unless the text tells us that. But what were some Pharisees doing just out in the middle of a grain field as Jesus walked through it with his disciples and they were picking the heads of grain on a Sabbath and began to eat them? As master, Jesus was responsible for his disciples' conduct. Culpepper says that by making this story about what the disciples did, the gospel storyteller may be beginning to set in place some points about occasional departures from Jewish Sabbath standards where real life made them necessary. Not rebellion for rebellion's sake, just because someone likes to live life all free and loosey-goosey. Not sheer anarchy. No one benefits when folks just start making up their own rules. But the practical act of clearing a path and some hungry guys nibbling on what they were clearing out of the way. It was a snack, if not a meal. We think of Jesus being pretty shy early on about not getting out ahead of his time. We'll see him do miraculous things, only to try to swear a whole crowd of folks to not say anything about it. But in this story, the Pharisee asked Jesus why what they were doing on the Sabbath was not unlawful. And you may remember that back in 1 Samuel 21, David and some of his men went into the temple at Nob and asked for bread. And the high priest who was on duty said that all they had was the consecrated bread of presence. Bread that had been baked on a Friday in preparation for the Sabbath because they could not do it on that day. It was sacred and had been devoted to the service of worship. Now, 1 Samuel 21, by the way, if you read it, reports that it was actually Ahimelech who was the high priest that day, not his son Abiathar, who would come much later and would rise to prominence one day. But the gospel writer says it was Abiathar, so that's what our story here in Mark has. The point is that David was feeding his men in that Old Testament story. It was practical. He made a judgment call and stopped at the temple because he knew there would be bread on hand. Should you be allowed to drop by the church at lunchtime and rifle through the communion closet just because your stomach's a little rumbly and you don't want to sit in the drive-thru that's backed up at McDonald's? Of course not. You're not David, and I'm not Jesus. No one of us probably ought to be unilaterally flaunting the traditions and practices of the church anytime soon. But there's something here for us to learn. I would be kidding myself if I thought I could swear a committee to secrecy when timing on something is important. But we watch Jesus ask for silence tied to his divine secret throughout the Gospels. Yet here, early in Mark's Gospel, Mark's telling of the stories, there is Jesus just blurting out to a Pharisee that he is, in fact, the Son of Man. Therefore, standards of conduct that could be violated by King David himself were analogous to Jesus and his band of merry disciples. Abruptly, and without any notion of repercussions, the scene shifts. Now Jesus and his group walk into a setting of worship. And again he entered the synagogue, it says. And a man was there who had a withered hand, and they watched him, they being the Pharisees, watched him to see whether he would cure him on a Sabbath so that they might accuse him. The man's hand was a problem to him. In a culture where you got what you worked for, he couldn't really. One commentary writer says that the story of the healing inside of the synagogue was probably just as simple as it is presented here. People knew of Jesus and they knew of the man in need, and the man was limited so severely. Word had spread that this Jesus could heal people. And in town, they heard that Jesus and his disciples were on the way to synagogue. So they just met him outside the door and asked him, it appears, could they help this man? They asked him because they didn't know any better than not to. There's something beautiful about their faith, if that's the way it happened, that compelled them to do that. They weren't sophisticated folks, nor, I am convinced, were they meaning to do anything wrong. This was pure faith in action. One among them was in need. One among them could help. They connected the dots. Then he said to them, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save a life or to kill?" But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart. You know, Jesus could do more teaching with one simple question than most of us can do in pages of manuscript. Notice that they had no response, these Pharisees who wanted to make trouble for him, but also notice that it didn't soften their hearts a bit, nor change their stance, what happened or what he said. Truly unhealthy people don't know that they're unhealthy. Unhappy people don't know that they're miserable and making everyone around them miserable too, I think. Here the system had become its own end, to the point that not healing someone that you could help seemed to make sense to everybody who was there, only because it was the wrong day to do so. And when the faith, our faith, makes people's lives better, then its beliefs and tenets make sense. When the Christian faith doesn't contribute anything to its neighborhood, doesn't visit grace or forgiveness on each other when it could, when the Christian faith doesn't make life happier, more bearable, and hopeful for anybody, then suddenly the days of the week just really don't matter. We can be glad that we don't have any of those Pharisees in our system today. Not so fast. I observed recently that some of the meanest, most unhappy, unhealthy, downright toxic people I've known over the years were also some of the God-talkingest Christians that you could ever be around. They were the kind of people who couldn't attend enough things at the church, couldn't go to enough Bible studies, but also just yap and yap and yap and bite around people's ankles like little chihuahuas everywhere they go. Mean. And truth be told, they're a little sad too, because the healthy people have mostly started to avoid them, and that's bad, but also understandable, don't you think? I mean, who wants a supposed friend who would sidle up to you and say, "Isn't it unlawful to be out here healing somebody on the Sabbath?" Or who would say, "Why are they plucking grain and eating it on Sabbath?" In the end, we can all heal, or we can all hurt. We get chances to make people's lives better, and in our best moments, we also pass up the easy chances to hurt each other. Every single day, you and I get opportunities to heal. No exceptions. All of us. All the time. Every day. And don't you think the world we live in could use all the healers that it can get? It can be the smallest thing, too. Billy and Harriet were an older couple that we knew in Milledgeville. They were the parents of a dear friend of ours. Billy and Harriet weren't able to have children of their own, but they adopted three that they raised and loved as though they were born of them. And after the war, Billy had finished college and become a CPA. He built a small local bookkeeping service, tax service there in the community, the county seat in Middle Georgia Town, where we served our first church. Eventually, he started taking some extension courses through one of the seminaries. And he cobbled together a decent education. Eventually, over time, Billy became the Sunday-only pastor of a little white wooden Baptist church outside town. And they didn't even have indoor plumbing at this little church. But for over 30 years, pastor and congregation loved each other. Eventually, Billy's daughter took over everyday responsibility for the bookkeeping and tax service, and seasonally he would come work for her to help her survive tax season. He kept on pastoring his little church in his retirement. One day, Billy and Harriet invited a bunch of us over for an open house. They had built their dream home. It was a brick ranch style on a beautiful piece of land. Billy himself, with a lot of borrowed local skilled labor, had served as the contractor and built his own house. We were so proud for them. The house truly was beautiful and nice. You had to love Billy and Harriet. They were such wonderful people, and we were all happy for them as though the house were our own. One Sunday morning, though, news began to spread around our church that something terrible had happened. The house, no more than 6 months old, had collapsed the day before. The house had simply broken in two and fallen into the basement underneath. Turns out that one of the things Billy hadn't gotten good advice on was how to build out the drainage system, and so water had been running toward the house instead of away from it. The foundation over those first few months had slowly, one rain at a time, just given away. Now, this was about 1994. We were on the seam of a new day, still commingling a little with the old. Blue laws weren't far gone, and the customs associated with a true deep South Sabbath practice, ones which I don't believe were all bad, by the way, still lingered in reality. I was raised that you didn't work on Sundays, period. You didn't do Little League, the grocery stores were closed, you didn't go to a movie on Sundays. It was just what was normal down in Georgia, and it was the way I was raised. As we left the church that day, in our little city at our fancy First Baptist Church, the only right conclusion that we friends and fellow ministers of Billy's could reach was that we needed to do something now. So we spread the word to everybody in our congregation that we thought would want to help out and thought that could. We went home and changed clothes, and we put on our work boots and grabbed any tools that we had, and everybody met up out at Billy and Harriet's as quick as they could get there. Until dark on that Sunday, when almost no one could stand any longer, we worked. I remember the fear of climbing down into that basement around the jacks and the braces that had been installed to keep the house from falling in any further. And we worked underneath there, shoveling mud and salvaging any belongings that we could and handing things out through the daylight that had just the day before been foundation and walls. As we took momentary breaks, we would climb back out of there, out of that basement, and we would go and stand and hug Billy and Harriet and cry with them if they were crying. And I drove home contemplating that evening after dark that I had just done hours and hours of manual labor on a Sunday for the first time in my life. And for a fleeting second, I mused on the conflict that I felt, but only for a second. Because something felt too obviously right for it all to be wrong. Years later, we would over and over again run into Billy and Harriet at Cooperative Baptist Fellowship meetings. We would embrace. They would reminisce about the day that it seemed their life, their dream, had collapsed around them, but also that out of the mud and wreckage, they had been healed. They had been loved back to life one work day at a time by a community that refused to let them suffer alone. It all started on a Sunday when folks realized that for that one exception, the most sacred thing they could do was to get dirty and muddy and give life. Thanks be to God. There's really no bad day to heal somebody. We come to the table this morning to serve each other.